Chapter 14. I got into the traveling chariot. It was of German make, roomy, heavy, and unvarnished. I got into the traveling chariot, pulled up the steps after me, shut myself in with a smart bang of the door, and gave the word, "Go on!" Immediately, all that W and S. W Division of London began to slide away at a pace so lively that I was over the river, and past the old Kent Road, and out on Blackheath, and even ascending Shooter's Hill, before I had had time to look about me in the carriage, like a collected traveller. I had two ample imperials on the roof, other fitted storage for luggage in front, and other up behind. I had a net for books overhead. Great pockets to all the windows, a leathern pouch or two hung up for odds and ends, and a reading lamp fixed in the back of the chariot, in case I should be benighted. I was amply provided in all respects, and had no idea where I was going, which was delightful, except that I was going abroad. So smooth was the old high road, and so fresh were the horses, and so fast went I, that it was midway between Gravesend and Rochester, and the widening river was bearing the ships, white-sailed or black-smoked, out to sea, when I noticed by the wayside a very queer small boy. "Holloa!" said I, to the very queer small boy, "where do you live?" "At Chatham," says he. "What do you do there?" says one. "I go to school," says he. I took him up in a moment, and we went on. Presently, the very queer small boy says, "This is Gad's Hill we are coming to, where Falstaff went out to rob those travelers, and ran away." "You know something about Falstaff, eh?" said one. "All about him," said the very queer small boy. "I am old, I am 9, and I read all sorts of books. But do let us stop at the top of the hill, and look at the house there, if you please." "You admire that house?" said one. "Bless you, sir," said the very queer small boy, "when I was not more than half as old as 9, it used to be a treat for me to be brought to look at it. And now, I am 9, I come by myself to look at it. And ever since I can recollect, my father, seeing me so fond of it, has often said to me, 'If you were to be very persevering, and were to work hard, you might someday come to live in it.' Though that's impossible," said the very queer small boy, drawing a low breath, and now staring at the house out of window with all his might. I was rather amazed to be told this by the very queer small boy, for that house happens to be my house, and I have reason to believe that what he said was true. Well, I made no halt there, and I soon dropped the very queer small boy and went on. Over the road where the old Romans used to march, over the road where the old Canterbury pilgrims used to go, over the road where the traveling trains of the old imperious priests and princes used to jingle on horseback between the continent and this island through the mud and water, over the road where Shakespeare hummed to himself, "Blow, blow, thou winter wind," as he sat in the saddle at the gate of the inn yard noticing the carriers, all among the cherry orchards, apple orchards, cornfields, and hop gardens, so went I, by Canterbury to Dover. There, the sea was tumbling in, with deep sounds, after dark, and the revolving French light on Cape Grinnis was seen regularly bursting out and becoming obscured, as if the head of a gigantic lightkeeper in an anxious state of mind were interposed every half minute, to look how it was burning. Early in the morning I was on the deck of the steam packet, and we were aiming at the bar in the usual intolerable manner, and the bar was aiming at us in the usual intolerable manner, and the bar got by far the best of it, and we got by far the worst all in the usual intolerable manner. But, when I was clear of the custom house on the other side, and when I began to make the dust fly on the thirsty French roads, and when the twigsome trees by the wayside, which, I suppose, never will grow leafy, for they never did, guarded here and there a moldy soldier, or field laborer, baking on a heap of broken stones, sound asleep in a fiction of shade, I began to recover my traveling spirits. Coming upon the breaker of the broken stones, in a hard, hot, shining hat, on which the sun played at a distance, as on a burning glass, I felt that now, indeed, I was in the dear old France of my affections. I should have known it, without the well-remembered bottle of rough ordinary wine, the cold roast fowl, the loaf, and the pinch of salt, on which I lunched with unspeakable satisfaction, from one of the stuffed pockets of the chariot. I must have fallen asleep after lunch, for when a bright face looked in at the window, I started, and said, "Good God, Louis, I dreamed you were dead." My cheerful servant laughed, and answered, "Me? Not at all, sir. How glad I am to wake. What are we doing, Louis? We go to take relay of horses. Will you walk up the hill?" "Certainly." "Welcome the old French hill, with the old French lunatic not in the most distant degree related to Stern's Maria, living in a thatched dog kennel halfway up, and flying out with his crutch, and his big head and extended nightcap, to be beforehand with the old men and women exhibiting crippled children, and with the children exhibiting old men and women, ugly and blind, who always seem by resurrectionary process to be recalled out of the elements for the sudden peopling of the solitude." "It is well," said I, scattering among them what small coin I had. "Here comes Louis, and I am quite roused from my nap." We journeyed on again, and I welcomed every new assurance that France stood where I had left it. There were the posting houses, with their archways, dirty stable yards, and clean postmasters' wives, bright women of business, looking on at the putting to of the horses. There were the postilions counting what money they got into their hats, and never making enough of it. There were the standard population of gray horses of Flanders descent, invariably biting one another when they got a chance. There were the fleecy sheepskins, looped on over their uniforms by the postilions, like bibbed aprons when it blew and rained. There were their jackboots, and their cracking whips. There were the cathedrals, that I got out to see, as under some cruel bondage, in no wise desiring to see them. There were the little towns, that appeared to have no reason for being towns, since most of their houses were to let, and nobody could be induced to look at them, except the people who couldn't let them, and had nothing else to do but look at them all day. I lay a night upon the road, and enjoyed delectable cookery of potatoes, and some other sensible things, adoption of which at home would inevitably be shown to be fraught with ruin, somehow or other, to that rickety national blessing, the British farmer, and at last I was rattled, like a single pill in a box, over leagues of stones, until madly cracking, plunging, and flourishing two gray tails about I made my triumphal entry into Paris. At Paris, I took an upper apartment for a few days in one of the hotels of the Rue de Rivoli, my front windows looking into the garden of the Tuileries, where the principal difference between the nursemaids and the flowers seemed to be that the former were locomotive, and the latter not, colon my back windows looking at all the other back windows in the hotel, and deep down into a paved yard, where my German chariot had retired under a tight-fitting archway, to all appearance for life, and where bells rang all day without anybody's minding them, but certain chamberlains with feather brooms and green baize caps, who here and there leaned out of some high window placidly looking down, and where neat waiters with trays on their left shoulders passed and repassed from morning to night. Whenever I am at Paris, I am dragged by invisible force into the morgue. I never want to go there, but am always pulled there. One Christmas day, when I would rather have been anywhere else, I was attracted in to see an old gray man lying all alone on his cold bed, with a tap of water turned on over his gray hair, and running, drip, 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 down his wretched face until it got to the corner of his mouth, where it took a turn, and made him look sly. One New Year's morning, by the same token, the sun was shining outside, and there was a mountebank balancing a feather on his nose. Within a yard of the gate, I was pulled in again, to look at a flaxen-haired boy of 18, with a heart hanging on his breast from his mother, apostrophe was engraven on it, who had come into the net across the river, with a bullet wound in his fair forehead, and his hands cut with a knife, but whence or how was a blank mystery. This time, I was forced into the same dread place, to see a large dark man whose disfigurement by water was in a frightful manner comic, and whose expression was that of a prize fighter who had closed his eyelids under a heavy blow, but was going immediately to open them, shake his head, and come up smiling. Apostrophe oh what this large dark man cost me in that bright city. It was very hot weather, and he was none the better for that, and I was much the worse. Indeed, a very neat and pleasant little woman with the key of her lodging on her forefinger, who had been showing him to her little girl, while she and the child ate sweetmeats, observed Monsieur looking poorly as we came out together, and asked Monsieur, with her wondering little eyebrows prettily raised, if there were anything the matter? Faintly replying in the negative, Monsieur crossed the road to a wine shop, got some brandy, and resolved to freshen himself with a dip in the great floating bath on the river. The bath was crowded in the usual airy manner, by a male population in striped drawers of various gay colors, who walked up and down arm in arm, drank coffee, smoked cigars, sat at little tables, conversed politely with the damsels who dispensed the towels, and every now and then pitched themselves into the river head foremost, and came out again, to repeat this social routine. I made haste to participate in the water part of the entertainments, and was in the full enjoyment of a delightful bath, when all in a moment I was seized with an unreasonable idea that the large dark body was floating straight at me. I was out of the river, and dressing instantly. In the shock I had taken some water into my mouth, and it turned me sick, for I fancied that the contamination of the creature was in it. I had got back to my cool darkened room in the hotel, and was lying on the sofa there, before I began to reason with myself. Of course, I knew perfectly well that the large dark creature was stone dead, and that I should no more come upon him out of the place where I had seen him dead, than I should come upon the Cathedral of Notre Dame in an entirely new situation. What troubled me was the picture of the creature, and that had so curiously and strongly painted itself upon my brain, that I could not get rid of it until it was worn out. I noticed the peculiarities of this possession, while it was a real discomfort to me. That very day, at dinner, some morsel on my plate looked like a piece of him, and I was glad to get up and go out. Later in the evening, I was walking along the Rue Saint-Honoré, when I saw a bill at a public room there, announcing small sword exercise, broad sword exercise, wrestling, and other such feats. I went in, and some of the sword play being very skillful, remained. A specimen of our own national sport, the British Bokes, was announced to be given at the close of the evening. In an evil hour, I determined to wait for this Bokes, as became a Briton. It was a clumsy specimen executed by two English grooms out of place, but one of the combatants, receiving a straight right-hander with the glove between his eyes, did exactly what the large dark creature in the morgue had seemed going to do, and finished me for that night. There was rather a sickly smell, not at all an unusual fragrance in Paris, in the little anteroom of my apartment at the hotel. The large dark creature in the morgue was by no direct experience associated with my sense of smell, because, when I came to the knowledge of him, he lay behind a wall of thick plate glass as good as a wall of steel or marble for that matter. Yet the whiff of the room never failed to reproduce him. What was more curious was the capriciousness with which his portrait seemed to light itself up in my mind. Elsewhere, I might be walking in the Palace Royal, lazily enjoying the shop windows, and might be regaling myself with one of the ready-made clothes shops that are set out there. My eyes, wandering over impossible wasted dressing gowns and luminous waistcoats, would fall upon the master, or the shopman, or even the very dummy at the door, and would suggest to me something like him. And instantly I was sickened again. This would happen at the theater, in the same manner. Often it would happen in the street, when I certainly was not looking for the likeness, and when probably there was no likeness there. It was not because the creature was dead, that I was so haunted, because I know that I might have been, and I know it, because I have been, equally attended by the image of a living aversion. This lasted about a week. The picture did not fade by degrees, in the sense that it became a whit less forcible and distinct, but in the sense that it obtruded itself less and less frequently. The experience may be worth considering by some who have the care of children. It would be difficult to overstate the intensity and accuracy of an intelligent child's observation. At that impressible time of life, it must sometimes produce a fixed impression. If the fixed impression be of an object terrible to the child, it will be, for want of reasoning upon, inseparable from great fear. Force the child at such a time, be Spartan with it, send it into the dark against its will, leave it in a lonely bedroom against its will, and you had better murder it. On a bright morning I rattled away from Paris, in the German chariot, and left the large dark creature behind me for good. I ought to confess, though, that I had been drawn back to the morgue, after he was put underground, to look at his clothes, and that I found them frightfully like him, particularly his boots. However, I rattled away for Switzerland, looking forward and not backward, and so we parted company. Welcome again, the long, long spell of France, with the queer country inns, full of vases of flowers and clocks, in the dull little town, and with the little population, not at all dull on the little boulevard in the evening, under the little trees. Welcome Monsieur the Cure, walking alone in the early morning a short way out of the town, reading that eternal breviary of yours, which surely might be almost read, without book, by this time. Welcome Monsieur the Cure, later in the day, jolting through the highway dust
as if you had already ascended to the cloudy region,
in a very big-headed cabriolet, with the dried mud of a dozen winters on it. Welcome again Monsieur the Cure, as we exchange salutations. You, straightening your back to look at the German chariot, while picking in your little village garden a vegetable or two for the day soup. I, looking out of the German chariot window in that delicious traveler's trance which knows no cares, no yesterdays, no tomorrows, nothing but the passing objects and the passing scents and sounds. And so I came, in due course of delight, to Strasbourg, where I passed a wet Sunday evening at a window, while an idle trifle of a vaudeville was played for me at the opposite house. How such a large house came to have only three people living in it. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.